Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
From a price side of things, when you look at the U.S. as compared to several other countries in the world and the rest of the world as a whole, we're not necessarily the most expensive place to buy fertilizer from.
Might not be a large piece of positive news, but Peyton Harper is with the Fertilizer Institute.
And so I just want to put this up here for everyone's reference, so that way you can kind of take a look at, you know, when we look at purchasing right out of the Gulf from New Orleans, you know, 900 per ton of urea, we get to DAP, you know, U.S. Corn Belt, 1,000 per ton of urea, and then, of course, again, in potash, you can see a little bit drop off there. Again, that's because of where our production lies and where our importing side lies as well, and where we're getting these products from.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Might I surprise y'all in the room to know that sorghum's been trading in the carbon market for the last 12 years.
Tim Lust is CEO for the National Sorghum Producers.
About a third of our crop goes into ethanol. Almost 100% of that goes to California as a part of what is called the California Low Carbon Fuel Standard. And it is, your price of ethanol is tied to your carbon score. So this is not new to us. It's something that we've been doing for a dozen years. The question is what's good and what's bad about it, and where is it going? A lot of people believe that if USDA or the government doesn't get involved in it, then Wall Street will drive what happens in this space. I'm not sure that I know and understand all of the trade-offs between the two. The point I want to make with you is the consumer, through stockholders, is more involved in your business than they have ever been. And if you think that's going to change, I believe you're naive. So, is this a serious question? I think it's a very serious question. Do I have the answers to this question? I do not have the answers to this question. But I can tell you, as an organization, we're spending an awful lot of time and an awful lot of energy. I just go back to about a year ago. I was scanning calendars, and I don't often do that, but I have the ability to view all my staff's calendars at one time. And there were all of these staff members that were on this call related to carbon. And I couldn't figure out what this call was that was so important that I had seven staff members on it. And so I started sending emails. They were on seven different calls. It was not one call. It was seven of them. So I just share that with you to give you the perspective of depending upon where you're at and how close to the consumer you are, this is something that is viewed very differently by different groups and organizations and industries, but it is something I think collectively agriculture has to figure out.
Reese Lingley is Vice President of Washington Operations for the National Cotton Council.
There is legislation that's moving through Congress called the Growing Climate Solutions Act. This is a bipartisan bill that the Senate has already approved, and it's pending in the House Ag Committee. There's some disagreement there about it, but I think we may ultimately see that enacted sometime this year. And the real purpose of that bill is to try to give USDA and the Secretary of Ag the authority and the ability to come in and try to set the rules of the road for these carbon markets and people that are going to be providing verification services and other things that producers would have to work with, so that you know if you decide to participate in one of these programs, it's at least been reviewed by USDA and is considered credible. So I think that could be one early step that we see happen.
And Lust adds,
USDA has announced $1 billion worth of grants that they will be awarding this summer. I know certainly our organization will be a part of that. I know National Cotton Council will be. And we've been working together to try to make sure that some of our back-end data collections will talk to each other. Because from the producer level, we all have to know. I mean, we all have to know whether some of this stuff, what the economic consequences of this are. Because right now we've got a lot of people talking about what this does or what this means, and we have very little farm level data to support any of what is being said today as the truth or the facts.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Obviously, we do have the grain market pressures, the feed market pressures. We've got lots of other issues, drought and other things that may impact that timing and the way that plays out. But the general trend is certainly for supportive supply fundamentals in the beef cattle industry.
Dr. Darrell Peel is Oklahoma State University Extension Livestock Economist on the drought.
You know, the time is not on our side here. It's springtime. We need to be getting greened up. We've got widespread drought conditions across much of the West. You know, with every passing day, we lose opportunity for that initial spring forage growth and hay production to begin. And so in a matter of a few weeks, probably not so much in the month of April, but as we move into May, June, if conditions do not change, I think we will see considerable pressure for some producers, many producers perhaps in various regions, to be faced with the prospect of having to make some additional culling decisions and reducing their stocking rates in the face of a lack of forage production. There's sort of two impacts from a drought. One is in the short run, you actually increase supplies of cattle in the market in general because of the liquidation, so more cattle coming to town. You know, that we're talking about cows, and that's probably where the biggest impact would lie. But we could also see it some time of year moving forward here when fall calving cows, for example, would normally be weaning. Some of those guys may be looking at early weaning. Go ahead and get those calves off. And depending on what their forage situation is, they may market those calves early. So I say all that to say that we'll probably see more cows coming to town if the drought persists. We will change the timing of feeder cattle supplies a little bit. But really, spring calving cows, we've got baby calves on the ground. We're going to try to hold on to those at least until June or July. We could do some early weaning that early. And so, you know, and then move those calves into a backgrounding program or whatever to take them on up to more normal weaning weights. All of that could have some changes in timing. It doesn't change the overall numbers of cattle, except maybe in the very short run. The longer-term implication is probably after 2022, you know, additional drought liquidation this year would set up even tighter supplies in 2023 and beyond for some period of time. And so we could actually exaggerate, if you will, this cyclical low in inventories a bit. That would be somewhat similar to what we did in 2011 and 2012. And it does raise that kind of a comparison when you start thinking about drought forcing us lower than we ever intended to be.
Peel has also been focused on the value of stocker gains.
You know, that's a funny situation. I watch those current market conditions and calculate value gain across the various weights of cattle and so on. And that's, at any point in time, that's usually a pretty good indicator of sort of what we're looking at. And if you look at that now compared to, say, last fall, that value gain appears to have eroded quite a bit. However, I think what's different this year that's a little unusual is that we've got so much of that optimism and that uptrend that we talked about earlier built into the market. You know, there's a $20 to $25 premium on fall feeder cattle futures compared to now. Mm-hmm. And so if you use those prices, then that value of gain still looks pretty good. And so, this is kind of an unusual situation where the current cash markets are set up very different than what the futures market is. And obviously the question is, how will that play out? Will we realize where that futures market is or anything close to that? If we do, then that value gain is going to be okay for some of these summer cattle. But, I think the point right now is that you really have to look into that futures market and probably do some risk management relative to the prices offered there to be sure that there's going to be that opportunity for a producer.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Times that we're in are difficult times. And I think only going to get worse here, unfortunately, as we reach into the fall.
That is G.T. Thompson. He's a representative from Pennsylvania, ranking member on the House Ag Committee at a recent farm bill hearing.
Good morning, everybody, and my thanks to our witnesses for spending time with us this morning. This is a timely conversation. I look forward to learning from you and thinking more comprehensively about how we can best move forward. We are at a crossroads. The geopolitical strife, weather-related disasters, pandemic-related impacts, and supply chain and inflationary crisis are wreaking havoc on the world, especially affecting those in vulnerable countries and communities. And there are so many simultaneous emergencies at the moment, So I don't want to take this opportunity. I do want to take this opportunity to extend my appreciation to USDA and USAID and all their partners for their tireless work to feed our world's hungry. You're truly doing God's work, and we thank you for that. And please pass that thanks along to your colleagues that work with you. However, there is much more to do. And that's why this hearing is so important. A review of Title III will allow us to learn what's working, what's not, what isn't, and to provide direction as we head into deliberation of the 2023 Farm Bill. And this conversation will also be informed by the crisis in Ukraine. As almost everybody knows, Ukraine is a large producer of grain. And together, Russia and Ukraine supply 26% of global wheat exports, and Ukraine supplies 13% of the world's corn. Ukraine is also the largest global supplier of sunflower oil. Russia is a major global supplier of fertilizer ingredients and oil and gas products. I think we have been meeting with some of the best thought leaders, trying to really map what we will see occur here into the fall. Looking forward to hearing your analysis and assessment of this, but everything we've heard and really leads to a pretty grim conclusion that by this fall, we're going to see significant increase in hunger, starvation, and death by famine. And with that, a destabilization that's going to result in violence and probably an increase in terrorism. When you think about the Middle East gets almost half its food from Ukraine, and these farmers are now on the front lines defending their nation, and the lack of supply of diesel fuel. We don't know if that winter wheat's going to get harvested, and we certainly don't anticipate where, if this continues, where the spring planting will occur. So as a result of the disruption to exports, global commodity markets have spiked and will continue to experience volatility. And this volatility leads to higher commodity prices. But there remain very real concerns over fertilizer and pesticide availability and their skyrocketing costs. So I echo my colleagues in hoping this hearing reveals more immediate solutions to these problems. Anything, obviously, I believe that we can do to provide tools to American farmers that they can increase their production at this point in time, which is challenging with inflation costs and availability of fertilizer and those things. But anything that we could do, and that the president can do, and I think there's some things that he could do immediately, to help increase that production by American farmers of just additional bushels. Because I believe with every additional bushel above and beyond what we normally would produce is lives saved somewhere around the world at this point in time.
House Ag Committee focused on Title III, the energy title. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
In the U.S., we always like to be number one. For the next three charts I'm going to show you, being number three and four is an extremely good place for us to be in this case. Global consumers, China, number one consumer of nitrogen. They're also the number one producer of nitrogen in the world. We're at third place here. Fourth on phosphates, and third again in potash, as far as consumers go in 2019. China, number one across the board in all three categories.
Peyton Harper is with the Fertilizer Institute talking about global demand for fertilizer.
We talked about China being the number one producer of nitrogen products in the world. That's ammonia, urea. We're third in both cases. Processed phosphates, third again, and potash. Now this one is the one to really pay attention to from our side. So potash, we rank 12th. And that's because as far as potash is concerned, it is a very, very limited resource as far as geographical proximity is concerned. There's only 11 countries in the world that actually produce potash. Two of which now, I'm sure you're all aware, we have some fairly major issues in play on, Belarus and Russia. And we'll talk about those here in a little bit as well, and what's impacting the world market from that side.
And on the import side?
We are the second largest importer of ammonia, third in processed phosphates, and second again in potash. This is actually a very good place for us to be in. Being such a large importer of these products over the past several years, This does not mean, and it does not change our position as far as supply is concerned. It also does not change our position as far as what our capacity for production is concerned. But what it does ensure is that there's typically, I won't say an excess, but there is typically adequate amounts of fertilizer from an imported side to keep the U.S. in a very positive trading balance and perspective from that angle in fertilizers.
But what about actually producing fertilizer?
Natural gas is a huge import of ammonia production, nitrogen production. So typically about 70 to 90% is our sweet spot here. That is how much natural gas is a component of ammonia production. So as the price of natural gas increases, obviously 70 to 90% of the number one input to produce that product, input costs also increase as far from production capacity. And we'll put that in a little bit of historical context here. From November to March of this past year, natural gas prices doubled. Natural gas prices doubled as far as what it costs to produce ammonia fertilizers and ammonia products in the U.S. Now, these are U.S. numbers. If I were to show you a chart showing European or global numbers in U.S. dollars, you would be just shocked. They're operating close to 10 to 13 to 1 from what we're still able to produce in the U.S. as far as natural gas is concerned. So quite a bit. You'll see here, you know, we spiked, we've leveled out a little bit, spiked again, and we've started a very slow incline right here. And again, this is numbers just from last week. So we're looking at very, very recent numbers and trend data to see that natural gas spiked, it's come down a little bit. Over time, we'll see that start to reflect back into the price of product, and hopefully we'll see that reflect back into the price of product in the supply line, but it's a very long trend. You may not see these start to impact for several months at this point.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
How intricate the fertilizer market is in the world. And I say the world because we're talking about a world commodity market here. World factors impact the price that we pay at our local ag retailer for fertilizer. So, it might surprise a lot of folks to know, but 90% of all nutrient use in the world for growing a crop each and every year is outside the U.S. Now, the U.S., we're a major user of all nutrient components in the world. However, 90% in total are used in other places.
Peyton Harper is with the Fertilizer Institute, but Dr. Gary Schnitke is a University of Illinois ag economist.
We developed a simple model that looked at that, including those factors, and lagged ammonia price when we predicted or looked at current ammonia price. That model explains anhydrous ammonia prices well up to October 2021. Corn and natural gas prices do a remarkable job, with corn prices being more important than natural gas. However, in November 2021, those prices began to diverge. And in fact, in November 2021, we saw a $400 higher actual price than what we would predict. And that's a large value that differs from what we've seen in any period from 2008 on. As we're looking at that, before October 2021, we can say that the typical factors that impacted all corn price and natural gas price also were in play. And if you're looking at those, corn and natural gas prices went up, and you can associate it with that a number of things, including the COVID pandemic and its responses, which really stretched supply change and changed demand, and also general price inflation. Price inflation has occurred because of COVID and also because of federal stimulus and anemic Fed policy combating that price inflation.
He does admit, however, other factors have been at play since back in November.
There were plant closures in the United States caused by planned maintenance and Hurricane Ida. And though Hurricane Ida shuttered plants in Louisiana after it hit there, There was also an anti-dumping suit brought by CF Industries against Trinidad and Tobago and Russia. Also, and probably most importantly, there was a divergence of natural gas prices in the U.S. and Europe. U.S. and Europe natural gas prices began to diverge and became quite large after July of 2021. There has been a great difference in natural gas situation in the U.S. and Europe. U.S. has relatively good supplies due to fracking, and Europe is relying more and more on natural gas as it attempts to reduce its use of fossil fuels and nuclear power. As it does so, it relied on natural gas as a bridge fuel, and much of that comes from Russia. Europe currently gets 40% of its supply from Russia, and that supply did not keep up with its demands in 2021. As a result, a number of plants closed natural nitrogen production in Europe in October and November, and that led to redirecting of supplies and much higher supplies around the world.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You know, we just kind of have to look at what was taken off that field last year and what nitrogen nutrients or nutrients may still be in that field that our crop could use this year, and then kind of make an educated decision on how much we could cut back on our nutrient applications for 2022.
Dr. Galen Morgan is Director of Ag and Environmental Research with Cotton Incorporated.
And, you know, just an example is that, you know, a lot of the research that was done by Texas A&M and others long ago, I mean, in many cases, they proved there's nitrates, soil nitrate, which is plant-available nitrogen in the soil, that those cotton, it will carry over from one year to the next. And, you know, if we can quantify that through, you know, soil sampling, then that can be credited and taken off what would typically be applied as nitrogen fertilizer. So I think that's one area that folks could definitely look at and, you know, possibly cut back on their nitrogen. You know, obviously, too, just taking into account the long-range weather predictions and things like that is just making sure the nutrient recommendations would be using a realistic yield goal. You know, we may not reach our, you know, average yields on a year like this. So maybe we need to cut back on, you know, have a realistic yield goal and be able to cut back on fertilizer from that perspective as well.
And for irrigated cotton.
And then on irrigated cotton, you know, I don't know exactly what the nutrient levels are in the, you know, the irrigation water out there, but I know, you know, it can be, you know, in the maybe 10 part per million on nitrates, for example. You know, and if growers know this already, what the nitrates are in their well water, if they have 10 parts per million, which isn't all that high, and they're applying 12 inches of water, that would equate to 27 pounds of nitrogen, plant-available nitrogen that they're applying to that field. So I think that could be credited and subtracted off, you know, a typical, what they would typically put out as nitrogen fertilizer as well.
Talks about the timing of fertilizer applications.
We definitely need to get a little bit of whether it's dry land or irrigated, I would suggest getting at least some of that fertilizer out, you know, just, you know, prior to planting or right at planting. You know, obviously with some of the weather forecast and the, you know, very little, if any, moisture in the soil profile, there's no use having too much money out there in the fertilizer form. But at the same time, we don't want to get, you know, too far behind. Like you said, if it turns off like it did last year and you get a lot of, you do get some rainfall in May and into June, we don't want to get too far behind the eight ball so that we can't catch up. And especially, you know, I don't know about the fertilizer supply chains out there, but if the supply chains are kind of backed up, you know, then getting fertilizer could be a bit of a challenge as well. So I think just kind of balancing that, putting out some of it up front and probably less up front this year than in years past, when the weather forecasts are better, but putting some of that up front and then coming in a timely manner, which would typically be, you know, we want to make sure that the nitrogen is there and available to the plant, which means down in the soil by the time that plant goes into kind of the late square to first bloom stage.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Corn typically shows the trend line in the U.S. commodity industry as far as crop production is concerned. And so if we follow through this, whenever USDA had predicted numbers, and they had predicted numbers back in August of 2020, they were looking at a $3.10 per bushel cost on corn. Luckily, factors have changed, and so now we have a predicted number of $4.30, which is the highest we've seen since 2013-2014 in corn prices.
That's Peyton Harper with the Fertilizer Institute on more good news for producers.
So opposite to what we saw in 2008-2009, commodity prices are not trending as down as they were at that time when we saw the last spike in price. However, we are seeing a pretty even trend line as far as what the predicted price of corn will continue to be for the next several months.